Greetings. I want to extend my appreciation for BL's help, Michael's, Rose, for their heart support and their technical skills, without which I would not be able to communicate a few aspects of the Ageless Wisdom teachings. Also like to give my thanks to Tulia, the Moya Federation, and the opportunity to share on this beautiful Valentine's Day, where the heart becomes the main theme, exoterically and esoterically. I would like to make a few comments on the opening image before we jump into this and just point out that some members of the group might find this comparison of the astral body to the cosmic astral plane to be quite a stretch. But as we will attempt to demonstrate and outline during this presentation, there are certain connections, however subtle and nebulous in the early stages. And under the law of correspondences, the greater will work through the lesser. Are you here, Tammy? And we can hear you, Rose. Say that again. Was that you, Rose, who made the comment? I'm sorry.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't, and I've muted the person, so go ahead.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. No problem. Before we jump into the presentation, I want to share with the group something that I did on Grok. We've had conversations about AI in previous presentations, and I think most everyone agrees that AI is really only as good as the consciousness or the person who's utilizing it. It can be used for all kinds of glamour and illusion, and AI and Grok can be used to make the teachings more visible or make them more attractive without losing the essential core of the teaching itself. And what you see here is one of the earlier versions of the Great Invocation, and it was changed, I think, twice. And most of us are more familiar with the latest version than the first and second. So I decided to take this wonderful mantra and animate it and give some audio to it. So that will be our opening sort of meditation, even if a short one. So relax, take a deep breath, and really open to these magnificent words.
Let the lords of liberation issue forth. Let them bring succor to the sons of men. Let the rider from the secret place come forth, and coming save. Come forth, O Mighty One. Let the souls of men awaken to the light, and may they stand with massed intent. Let the fiat of the Lord go forth. The end of woe has come. Come forth, O Mighty One. The hour of service of the saving force is now arrived. Let it be spread abroad, O Mighty One. Let light and love and power.
Excellent. So now moving into the next slide.
Let the Lord.
Did I cut that off too early? Can anybody give me some feedback on that gradient vocation?
Just a tad. You cut it off in the
Yes.
middle of the last line.
Oh, I apologize for that. I love this quote from Esoteric Healing, where the Tibetan states, "Preparation too must be given to the development of the higher psychic powers, and through the trained expression of those powers, can proof be given to the scientists of the world of the latent forces in man, which can be utilized by those who wisely and sanely follow in the footsteps of the Christ, the greatest psychic of all time." It's interesting, my training in esotericism began in the late 60s, and in the next 20, maybe 25 years, when you even mention the word psychism around the Bailey material, you often got a whole outcry of very advanced mental intellectual types that would point out the different places DK states that psychism is dangerous and we need to stay away from it. However, and I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, have come to the realization, psychism has its higher and its lowest in its lower form. And that, yes, it is unwise and dangerous to force psychism to emerge in your life when it really will emerge naturally because it's a quality of the soul. And here we have a list that the Tibetan outlines of how telepathy and psychism in its higher form can be shared or distributed. And you can see here we have a dream experience, a symbolic teaching, the thought form of a master, a direct contact with the master in meditation, an interview in a master's ashram. The first three are more usually the experience of the probationary disciple, although we have to understand a lot of these stages can overlap and merge. The last two are undergone by the accepted disciple. They have their astral or lower psychic counterparts. They are, in this case, not all glamour and illusion, and are not basically reprehensible, for they are, in reality, the seed or guarantee of future inevitable experience upon the way. People do see the thought forms of the masters, for those thought forms exist. They do receive symbolic teachings upon the astral plane or in the dream states. Beginners and the inexperienced are then apt to do one of two things: overestimate their importance, or they dismiss it as undesirable lower psychism, forgetting that so-called lower psychism is only so when the interpretation and the use of the experience is at fault. Very, very important distinction here about different ways that the psychic and the telepathic can be shared. The centers above and below the diaphragm have only one point of energy, but the solar plexus itself has two points of dynamic energy, one most ancient and awakened, being the expressive of the life of the astral or lower psychic body, and the other to be brought into conscious activity of the soul. When this has happened, the awakening to the higher issues of life makes the disciple sensitive to the higher psychic gift waves. So let us look at this in a little more detail, then we'll show a tabulation that can frame this. There are two points of vital light within the solar plexus, which makes this center of dominant importance in a clearinghouse for the centers below the diaphragm to those above it. One of these points of light is connected with the lower psychic and astral life, and the other is brought into livingness by the inflow from the head center. I would here remind you that the centers above the diaphragm have only one vital point of energy, while the centers below the solar plexus have only one, but that the solar plexus itself has two points of dynamic energy, one most ancient and awakened, being expressive of the life of the astral or lower psychic body, and the other waiting to be brought into conscious activity by the soul. When this has happened, the awakening to the higher issues of life makes the disciple sensitive to the higher psychic gift waves, as the Tibetan occultists call them, of the spiritual world. So here is an illustration of what we have just outlined in the last two quotes. On the right-hand side, you have what is called the more feminine centers, which is the solar plexus and the heart. And the Ajna is actually a dual center expressing the heart energy, but also Ray 3, active intelligence. On the left side, you have the more masculine centers. So let us focus over on the right-hand side where it says solar plexus, Ray 2, second initiation. If you can take those two discs, bottom right of that, I guess you would call it the triangles of life. Some people call it the tree of life. You'll see that the solar plexus has a horizontal line drawn through it. And at the black dot in the center represents the fourth subplane, counting from above down or below up. And the three higher subplanes above that white horizontal line, it relates to the three higher subplanes of the solar plexus and are evolutionary, and they can be connected to the heart. You can see they pass up through the diaphragm and they connect into the heart. And when you're operating from the three lower subplanes of the solar plexus, they are involutionary, and they often relate more to the base of the spine, the sacral center, and the throat. And there's a place where this transmutation is going on all the time, and it's not that easy to distinguish the higher three from the lower three in the early stages, but everyone here knows the difference between having an elevated moment of revelation in the emotional body that's really coming directly from the heart, and the three lower subplanes of the solar plexus where the undesirable visualizations accompany too much personality energy and potentially, because the sacral center can be a sacred center, but in this case, it can interfere with clarity because it fuses and interacts with self-will, which is the base of the spine, and involutionary six ray coming from the solar plexus, which is like fear, intimidation, and dread, and the sacral, of course. It is a sacred center in its three higher subplanes, but when overemphasized, it brings holds the student below the threshold of the soul's ability to shine its light. So are there any questions about this chart in the solar plexus center and its relationship? Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that, you know, the Dhyana meditations that DK gave us?
Yes.
Well, he started with Dhyana 1, and then he added Dhyana 2 to it. And that Dhyana 2, the second meditation that he gave to his
Yes.
group, and this awakens the group response. It
Yes.
specifically, part of it addresses that the embryonic interplay that's being established between the lower awakened point and the upper awakening point in the solar plexus. So it helps you to understand the difference between them and to open that upper one and then raise it to the heart in this particular meditation. So I just wanted to
Excellent.
point that out.
Excellent addition, BL. And if there's anyone else that has a question or would like to share an insight, okay, excellent. Well, we'll go to the next.
Whoops, sorry.
No, that's fine.
Diana says, wait a minute, I just lost it. Okay. Yoka asks which page in Dhyana 2. I'll put the meditation in the remarks. Okay. Diana says, is there an explanatory description of this diagram, which is really a summary of the science of the centers? And I thought there was another one there from you, Diana, but I don't see it. How did I lose it?
In the bottom left, you'll see a little text that says modified and adapted from Treatise and Cosmic Fire, page 169 to 170. You go into that area and you'll get a much broader and deeper understanding of what I have no doubt just inadequately expressed. Excellent. Any additional comments?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, excellent. My mouse just malfunctioned. Rose, are you available to activate my mouse that just stopped working? And I might be able to do it this way. Yes, I guess I'll have to do it with my keyboard. Okay, sorry for that snafu. This is a wonderful quote that sort of frames the direction we're taking this conversation. And I have a cat that's jumping on my keyboard. Okay, sorry for the interruption. Okay, I have to put my cats in my bathroom because they're jumping on my keyboard. I'll have to excuse myself. Okay, sorry for the disruption, but I have two very beautiful female cats that are very affectionate, and they occasionally dive onto my keyboard. And let's just see if we can sit back. And I have retrieved the use of my mouse. So let me just. Okay. Yeah, there's where we left off. Rose, could you turn the top of that down? It's like a strobe light. Yeah, doesn't have to be all the way down. That's good, right there. Okay. Sensing the master's vibration. In connection with this matter of sensing vibration, it is of value to remember that all sensing is naturally and normally an astral or an emotional reaction. In considering my group, I am impressed, yes, and somewhat amused by the effort of some of you, and of you in particular, is referring to a disciple to which this is written, to repudiate a emotional or astral sensitivity. Some of you admit it, but regard it as undesirable. Others consider it as something to be inhibited or to be unexpressed and ignored. Few of you, if any, look upon the astral body as a divine expression of reality with its definite and specific uses. The astral body is, in its time and place, of as real value, purpose, and usefulness as the mind. It serves to relate the higher impressions to the lower, and you cannot record my vibration in the physical brain consciousness except through its meditation, excuse me, its mediation. You can be aware of my vibration upon the plane of the soul, and your mind consciousness can be impressed by it, unless, however, the sensory body, the emotional vehicle, is also active in the right sense, negative to the world of the senses and receptive to mental impressions. That impression will not be registered in the brain or the waking consciousness. So, here we have a statement by the Tibetan where he's talking about the importance of right aspiration. And he states it is the logos of the sixth ray, Venus. Now, we also know Venus relates to r the fifth ray, the second ray, and it depends on where the student is situated. And it controls the astral centers in man. When a man coordinates his buddhic vehicle, he begins to escape from the etheric web on the physical plane. This leads to causal perception or an ability of the man to dwell in the consciousness of the ego on its own plane. The devas that tend the fire that eventually destroys the causal body are called Agnishurans, and are the fiery essence of Buddha. Their lowest manifestation is the astral plane. Hence the reason why right aspiration and purity of motive create the transformational fires that send the student in the early stages of his quest on his way. So this is a very interesting statement because he's talking about the Agnishurans, who are the essence of Buddha. But he also says their lowest manifestation is the astral plane. So this might appear as a contradiction on the surface, but it indicates the rays and the principles that we're always discussing and interfacing with, they are malleable and they span the rays. Sometimes the highest aspect of one ray on another turn of the spiral is the lowest aspect on that stream of the next higher ray. And they can alternate because, as we will try to demonstrate here, the rays in the planes must be seen spherically, must be seen vortically to really understand apparent contradictions. Okay. Next
Do we have
slide.
a
I'm
hand up?
sorry. Please.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Yes, it seems that it's possible to travel within the astral plane. The Egyptians were able to do this a lot in a kind of new moon shaped canoe. We're able to travel places outside of the field of the body on the astral. And I wonder if this relates to imagination in the astral body.
Absolutely. The astral body is the seat of the imagination, and it has seven subplanes. And when you are operating from the three higher subplanes of the astral, your visualizations will be powerful, and they will have a propensity to be attracted to the next principle again, which is not totally divorced, but is like its higher corollary, which is the Buddhic plane. Just as the Buddhic plane is the stepping stone to the monadic, and then eventually the cosmic astral plane. So the highest point on one plane becomes the lowest on the next higher corollary. And we have to remember when dealing with the Egyptians that they had some very high initiates at that time. And when they talk about the astral plane, it's really, if they're a part of the inner secret initiation, it really relates to the high astral and low Buddhic plane. And a lot of those teachings were lost as that wave of impression, the Egyptian mysteries, played their part and then are now being replaced and infused with more of an Aryan, more of a fifth ray. And it's a fascinating study. Okay, any additional comments?
We have another hand and we have a comment. I'm sorry, I can't say that name. It says, we travel every night as astral, as I understand.
Yes,
Cosmic
and
astral plane is the electric substance of light, right?
yes, and we get a lot of the teachings on the astral plane from the ashram, and it depends on the quality of it in which center we're operating, or in this case, if we're talking about the astral plane, which subplane. The visual image that I demonstrated earlier had this horizontal line that separated the three higher subplanes from the three lower. Three lower deal with elementals, which are involutionary. The three higher deal with actually an extension of the solar angel. That's how advanced they are. And when they are elevated fully into the soul body, initiation takes place not just on the mental plane, but on that very high astral. Okay, any additional comments or
Yes,
shares?
we have a hand. Heidi, go ahead, please.
Thank you. The only thing I wanted to just add is that understanding of that luminous substance, you could even call it a plasmic substance that allows travel and flow. It's the clarity of the apparatus. I don't know how to put it any other way, but the instrumentation that allows for that clarity. So part of the purification process of consciousness has to do with purifying the Well, you could call it the mind. It's really hard to use words because everybody has a different understanding for it. But it's the flow and the movement, and it actually burns away what has completed itself because it has tremendous intelligence actually within it. And it's the lack of consciousness about that and the lack of, understanding, I guess I'll use that word, understanding that the mind that is present understands this process. And I think when it goes into the fifth ray, which is what you're talking about, it allows for a more scientific understanding of it, which actually brings about a presencing to the wholeness of life. And that brings about much of the changes that are aspiring, of those energies are actually aspiring to. So the more that those energies can flow through their natural process, they actually do the work. I don't know how to say it any other way, but they do the work. It's more about being able to understand it and having a understanding through the mind that actually is the instrumentation that allows for that energy to continue its natural process. And it becomes less work when it's in those realms. And then the energy, and then the and then what is needed to understand is actually given. It's just like graced into the system. So the work is more about, to me, is more about making the instrumentation clear so that that actually can happen more naturally. So anyway, I just thought I'd add that. Thank you.
Excellent. I appreciate your comments, and it would take a little more time than we have today to fully address your important and deep insights. But I would say this, that the question that often comes up in discipleship training is, how much do I do versus how much does the soul or angel do? And this is an oversimplification, but when the invocation is correct according to your ray makeup or where you are on the path, it goes up through the ethers and it stimulates the soul, which is gazing outward towards the infinite and its development. And this is what causes it to turn its gaze down to the lower instrument or the personality in its three lower vehicles and help in lifting those energies up into its superior body of fire and light. And the work is something that's cooperative. And this is why when you get into the six stages of building the Antahkarana, you at the third have invocation, evocation, because that's where the disciple's work that has been laid down scientifically is able to take the lower mind and make that transition to the higher subplanes of the higher mind and eventually into the Buddhic field. Because if you continuously hold on to that strong thought form of building the bridge from the lower mind into the higher mind or the emotions into the Buddhic plane, you actually prevent it from happening. It's a curious paradox, but it's one that every disciple has to face. And they don't necessarily have to know the technicalities of this process, but it's good to have a general outline. Because if the thought forms are not dissipated, the alignment cannot take place because the very essence of the lower mental faculty creates a barrier. A very, very interesting paradox. So when you are building the six stages of the Antahkarana and you get to the third stage, this is where you pass over from invocation, sending out the stream, the invocative demand, and then evocation, where the soul hears your call and responds. And this is a process that in the early stages seems somewhat awkward, and but later on, as Heidi has eloquently outlined, it becomes very organic. And the lower mind, with all its questioning, its doubts, its smaller thought forms, it becomes passive. And then that stream of light you've sent out is no longer thwarted or held back, impacts the soul body. The soul body, by law, has to respond, and it pours down into the attentive disciple, as long as he can maintain not an empty mind, but a mind anticipating and waiting to receive the great gift of the solar angel. So that was excellent, Heidi. And we have to remember that the fifth ray, in its higher aspect, is a very evolutionary entity, and that simply memorizing or quoting with the lower mind all these different attributes of the rays and the planes and the different levels is only a prelude to realizing that this fifth ray is a great expanded and luminous being, and it goes way beyond the mental plane as we can understand it, and it is a huge and great revelation. But until humanity, until disciples and different groups are able to get out of the lower mind into the higher mind and into the light that that higher mind veils, it can stymie progress. And it's a paradox. You need the mind to go beyond the mind. And that's where the technique that are given by the masters lie. I don't care what area you study. One of the first things, if you've done the preliminary work, is to be able to subdue, not necessarily destroy, because you want your mental faculties after the revelation to kick in, not to thwart it, but to kick in and ground it, because it goes from the mental down into the etheric, the physical, the astral. So thank you, Heidi. That was excellent. And it's a cooperative endeavor between the personality and the solar angel on its own plane. Okay, any additional comments at this point?
Yes, we got a couple of them. Heidi says,
Okay.
thank you, well spoken. Francis says, the invocation, the in-breath, and evocation, the out-breath.
Yes. And during meditation, that's one of the first things you learn, is that there's an in-breath and an out-breath. And you have periods where you stop in the stillness and you allow that which you've invoked to enter into you. And here's one of the greatest paradoxes of the third initiation in advanced group work. If your thought form is too powerful, it will prevent the solar angel from responding to that demand. And you make the demand, but then you go from active to active passive. And no one, I don't care how advanced they are, can tell you how that's done other than these rudimentary outlines eloquently provided by Blavatsky and Bailey and all masters. But it's something that you only learn through discipline and repetition, where you can let go of the thought form gently as you allow the thing that you're invoking to take its place. Okay. Excellent. Any additional comments?
Yes, Sri Yanta Shanti says, a strong etheric body via spiritual practices, whichever suits each allows them, the divine, to work through us. We, personality, can step aside.
That is beautifully shared, and it's all about how the personality can be subdued, how it can be in how it can be receptive without chasing or creating a barrier between the thing you're invoking and yourself. And this is advanced work with meditation. It's not just visualization, it's knowing when the visualized image that you have created, especially if you're a second-rate disciple, you can lessen the potency of that because the thing that you're invoking now wants to enter into your auric field. And if you keep the potency of that thought form too high, it will be deflected. And it will come another day when you've learned the technique of actively sending out this invocative cry. And when the response you feel coming back to you from the solar angel or the monad or some deva, you have to make yourself passive. But not passive as the definition is commonly understood. It's more of a passive active, but the activity part is not so strong that it prevents the subtle and luminous deva that operates from having its ability to come into your auric field through your head centers. And I apologize if I sometimes make some of these questions overly technical, because it's not really that technical. And paradoxically, when you do this evocation correctly, it's like breathing. It's organic. You make the demand, you sit in the silence, and the deva or the master or the next higher level on our rung of evolution responds. You're no longer pushing out. You've made a receptive vehicle for that impression to come. Okay, good. Any additional comments?
Nope, that's all I see right now.
Okay.
Oops, spoke too soon. Susie says it is holding sacred space for. She didn't finish it. You want to finish it, Susan? Susie? Go ahead, talk.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm talk about tech challenged. I am. Yeah, the thought I missed a little bit of it too because I lost you for a bit. The thought occurs to me that it's holding. It's an active but a gentle holding of a sacred space for what you are attempting to manifest. There's nothing really passive about it except for the fact, like you said, the paradox of the holding in itself is creating a vessel, so it's receptive, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely makes perfect sense. And the idea of thought forms can easily drive away the subtle devas that the Christ brings to lift humanity individually, as groups, and of course, the whole race of humanity. And nobody can tell you how to get that active, passive fluidity that has just been outlined. And it's not a negative state where the operator is sort of not even aware of what's going on. You're active enough to see the process unfolding, but your mental body is not overstimulated to the point where it drives the subtle devas away. Okay. Let us proceed. More and more as the race progresses, symbols will be used and words less employed. A symbol stands for a thought, an idea, and expresses in one definite form what many words would be needed to define. A symbol makes its appeal through the eye and not the ear, and directly tends to develop the imagination, that power which exists on astral levels, that world which we use to express something which is hidden from us. Drawing upon our imagination for its elucidation, then the imagination directly leads to the development of the intuition. Well, this is just a profound statement, this idea of using the imagination directly, and that the imagination in each person, each participant, is the rudimentary field of the higher intuition. Because when you see the astral plane in the buddhic plane in a spiral, with the astral being lower and the buddhic being higher as it spirals around a vortex or a sphere, you can see why the Tibetan will make statements about the astral and the buddhic plane, or the mental and the atmic plane, that seem to contradict each other. But when you see things vortically, spherically, and that's one of the purposes of these presentations, in spite of all the rhetoric and all the quotes and stuff, is to be able to develop that more intuitive feel, because the astral plane has a direct link with the buddhic, just as the buddhic does with the monadic. Okay. Let's move forward here, and my mouse keeps cutting out on me. I'll just see if I can do it.
You have a hand up, a question?
Okay.
Go ahead, please.
Is that me?
Yes.
Thank you, Gil. I just want, very briefly, maybe you can reiterate a little bit from your explanation. I'm hearing the word sphere, sphere, sphere in the perception, or imagination, or intuition that was in your message. And I honed on it and I lost a little bit what was around it. Can you please just repeat that thought or sentence? I would like to attain it a little bit more. Thank you.
Well, I think that to answer your question, that the next image that we're going to experience as an animation will explore what you have just shared. It shows the seven rays in motion. And any explanation that I could give to your important question would not even
I don't hear you. I'm sorry.
come
Yeah,
close to the next
we just
image,
lost
because it
you.
shows. Okay, so can you hear me now? Your
Yes, you're
interconnect
back. Yes,
is
thank you.
unstable. Okay, well, anyway, your question is an important one, and a sphere or a vortex better represents any one or all of the seven rays which we're attempting to interface with. No matter what initiation you're going through, you're dealing with the rays in the planes. So the next animation that I'm going to share after I share this quote might be very instrumental in helping you see these ray forces organically, spherically, n not as like plates stacked one upon the other, but as living entities that have entry points and exit points, and that are round and spherical, and that there can be many spheres nesting one within the other, which hopefully we can get into that a little bit as we move along. So let us just read this quote. Would anybody like to read this for us before we do the animation?
I'd like,
I'll
if
read it.
you don't mind. I'll be able.
The astral body should become the transmitter from the Buddhic plane. As evolution proceeds, the astral body should prove incapable of being swayed by thought currents and the separative process of that plane, and negative to the Buddhic plane, or receptive to the forces from that plane. When it has attained equilibrium and the forces are evenly balanced, the astral body should become the transmitter from the Buddhic plane.
Excellent. Unless you can begin to understand the rays as spherical or as spirals, some of this language is a little difficult to understand. And that's why images or animations are so powerful, because the Tibetan can create a whole chapter on some subject and then say, but of course, it's almost impossible. Until you develop clairvoyant vision or clairaudience to understand some of these statements I'm making. So my work, in a very small and perhaps insignificant way, is to take these comments by the Tibetan and see them in animated form. So let's go to the next image and. Okay, I have a mouse that just ceased to work on me right now, so I'll have to use my another technique here. Okay. Now, the seven rays are normally depicted as ray one, red in the very center, because it's the will of the Father, it's the principle of directed purpose. It's what starts the whole movement of the rays as they undulate out from that central point of pure abstraction. But here, for purposes of teaching and exploration, I have put the Buddhic quality, that yellow as an eye, in the center. And from that Buddhic plane, the other rays rhythmically move out. And this is sort of a symbol of humanity, because humanity has a fourth ray soul. And the fourth ray is very, very important because eventually, when it's fully recognized, it represents the Buddhic plane of unconditional love that can only be really understood, according to the masters, at the fourth initiation. But we can have visions and we can have insights and we can have cracks of that pouring through in our personalities, in our occult work. So I want everyone to see this image as the seven rays, and it's just we're starting with the fourth ray in the center, third ray green, fourth ray in the center, fifth ray orange, sixth ray rose, seventh ray violet, and the first ray is more in the outer periphery, upper right, as red. So this is a little different than what I normally demonstrate, but now I'm going to go into a full-blown animation, and I want each participant to, without straining, see the unfoldment of the rays, how, as the Tibetan and many masters have indicated, it's like a drop of water in a still pool. It starts as a very, very subtle but powerful ripple in the center, and in this case, the Buddhic plane, the plane of love wisdom, and it slowly ripples out, bringing vitality to all the other rays and stimulating them into their potency and contribution. Okay.
Thank you.
We can see your new slide, Duane, but we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Some of these animations clarify that each person is not only multidimensional with their ray makeup, but that we're all in a state of movement, and the physical body, it gives us a distorted view of the inner person. The inner person is a series of rays that are unfolding and in constant motion. And that's the general idea of that last video we just shared. So let's go to the next quotation. Would somebody like to read this?
Yes, just a minute. You have Heidi's got her hand up for a question, and then I think
Okay.
Joe has her hand up to read. Go ahead, Heidi.
Thank you. I loved that, Duane. And I just wanted to say something got really clear by looking at that, which was it had to do with as long as the vibrations that are flowing in, you could say, to the nervous system, and then the way that the brain interprets those, if they're unable to stabilize, then there's no vision that can actually come through. It will always come through as a distortion. It was really, that was what came through when I was looking. It was showing me that. And I thought, oh, that is just so beautiful that that imagery really brought that piece clear because, of course, before light, there's vibration. But that vibration again has to be held in that presencing of that line that was in your first picture,
Yes.
and then the image can be given, and then it's not just given to the person who's receiving it, it's actually given to the whole of life. It's just given out. It's not held in a in an identification of something, it's just given. Anyway, it was really beautiful. So I just want to say it had a deep resonance in your artistry, had a deep resonance to my soul. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Heidi. And I agree with everything that you're sharing. This stability and holding into that light as it does its work. I would love to think that I'm doing something unique, but the only thing unique I am doing as an artist is being able to take a few images and animate them the way the masters describe them. And if you feel sympathy around some of these images, you don't have to always be able to articulate it mentally, like some of us might be able to do. You just get into that high astral Buddhic and you sense it, you move into it, you become it. And you're no longer the observer, you are the full participant in what the hierarchy is attempting to bring through the Deva evolution for our growth and development. Okay, excellent. Anyone like to read about the astral plane?
Hold on a minute.
BL asked me to read. Do you want me to?
Sure.
I had a
Just a minute.
question before.
Just a minute, Joe.
Sure.
Sorry. Francis says in the video, I felt my personal rays vibrating sequentially with the moving imagery.
Well, that is a profound statement because that is actually, to go back to some of the statements I've just made, the purpose of these presentations, that the individuals will see a new way to enter into the rays. Now, this is not to say everyone here hasn't made tremendous progress or on the path of evolution, or you probably wouldn't be a part of this group and other groups, but it's about creating the mental framework that we can break down later. In other words, somebody could say, well, this is very inconsistent. This gentleman, with all good intentions, me, is talking about going beyond the mental plane, and here he is going over and over and over all this minutia. But it's good to have a mental understanding. And when you have the experience of these animations within yourself, in your auric field, the information you can go back and relate to, because that's the first thing it'll disappear is either my pontifications on this process or the quote itself. And this is what DK constantly affirms, that all that the guide can do is present to you a new way of looking at your own process. And I love this group because it's gone beyond the teacher stage, and they're wise enough to listen when anybody who speaks and wants to share can say something important. And this is not about teachers and control issues and all kinds of stuff I've seen so many times. So I want to thank everyone for coming, and I appreciate their position, their attitude, and their contribution, even if they don't even squeak one word. Excellent. Okay, anything else you wanted to share, BL?
No, that's it. Go ahead, please, Joe, reading.
Okay, first a question. Duane, you commented that what we see on the interior as the form is unfolding is not necessarily what expands out to the edges. I don't know if I understood that correctly, but I want to comment that personally, I seem to relate to the yellow, then green, and then rose. On the interior, but when I go to speak it, I found myself going out to the edge and seeing that we had a strong ray seven on the very edge, and it was the purple indigo that probably relates to everyone. That
Well,
question,
people, go
the
ahead.
question there is, I have a notion that the way we serve might come out on the outer edge and it would vary.
Absolutely, because that's where our lower vehicles are situated and where all these higher energies eventually ground themselves. Your type of service that you have chosen in this lifetime, and it can be multiple things, is directly determined by your ray makeup and which rays are prominent in your chart when you do up a six-fold ray chart, and also the rays through the astrological signs. It's a art, it's a science, and all we can do here is to bring our attention, because I learned so much from this myself, to where this research might be leading or how it may be entered other than just academic study, which is a great foundation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
I'll read now. Agnisurians, and in their totality, and the fiery essences of Buddhi, the astral plane. The fiery essences of this plane are more difficult for us to comprehend, having not as yet the seeing eye upon that plane. They are in themselves the warmth and heat of the emotional body and of the body of feeling. They are of a low order when upon the path of desire, and of a high order when upon the path of aspiration. For the elements is then transmuted, the elemental is then transmuted into the deva. Their grades and ranks are many, but their names matter not save in one instance. It may be of interest to know the appellation applied to the devas of fire, whose part it is to tend the fires that will later destroy the causal body. We need to remember that it is the upspringing of the latent fire of matter and its merging with two other fires that causes destruction. These elementals and devas are called the Agnisurians, and in their totality are the fiery essences of Buddhi. Hence, their lowest manifestation is on the sixth plane, the astral.
Excellent, Joe. Thank you. So we see that the Agnisurans that relate to the essence of Budai have their lowest manifestation on the sixth plane, the astral plane. And to me, that is utterly profound because here DK is explaining why you have to see the rays spherically. And how that the Buddhic plane is connected to the astral plane. And Budai will manifest on the astral plane through its subplane, which is the fourth subplane. And that's why when you study the planes and the rays, you eventually have to see how the subplanes interact, like the warp and woof of a finely knit shawl or fabric that. They're visible at one moment, then they disappear, but then only to reappear in another part of the grand mosaic that we call life, that we call reality. So this statement clarifies in a small way a number of apparent contradictions, because later DK will talk about the Agnisurans and then as being the essence of Budai, but then he'll talk about Agnisurans and its relationship to the high astral plane, which seems like a contradiction, but when you see it, you see the totality of it. It is not. But let's go to the next image and see how this fits in the grand scheme. This is sort of a generic view of the Antahkarana Bridge. And I'm not going to go into any detail other than say this is a very, very stepped down version of what the Tibetan says about on the left, you have the devas. You have their color note in the left-hand column. You have their ray and you have their deva. And on the right-hand side, you have the planes. And all existence is the result of some abstract, powerful energy called Fohat impacting the rays, or I should say, creating the rays in the planes as they express their abstract into manifestation. Okay, on the left, you have the basic colored notes that the Tibetan has given. Ray one all the way down to ray seven. Now remember these notes can be veils and they can be accurate, but they're not the full picture. As Michael and I learned way back in the 70s when we started seriously studying this and putting it into practical application with the PhD that he initiated and had Dr. Robert Gerard and myself participate, we refined this, and then he went on to present it to no doubt many people in this group with his encyclopedic knowledge. Okay, on the opposite end, you have the planes, the initiations that relate to that level, and their colors. And I have spent roughly 50 years trying to figure out the colors of the rays in the planes. And I'm not saying these are accurate, but they're accurate enough, according to Blavatsky and Bailey, because there are gaps and things are left out. An overview of those seven rays. And you'll note that the seven rays with their unique colors are the direct opposite of the seven planes. Again, creating the tension or I'll call polarity, in which the rays and planes can weave into their magnificent spherical vortical lives. So when we look at this, we can see the Agnishurans down on the Ray and Deva column, all the way almost to the bottom. The bottom is Kashiti, and then the next one up, the sixth ray, the astral, is the largest carrier of that energy is the Deva Lord Varuna. But then it's broken down into subsidiary groups of Agnishurans. And Adike is just pointing out here in this quote a little insight into that. And these are very useful tabulations because they're simplifications. And if you want the full Monty, just go into DK's teachings, and I usually have reference to what page some of this is found on. Although this one doesn't, because it's extracted and extrapolated from so many different DK sources. Okay, excellent. Let's move forward to the next quote. The growth of what we might call the Buddhic vehicle prepares the man for the ninth or the final initiation. Now, that is profound because the Buddhic vehicle is normally associated with the fourth ray or the fourth initiation. But just like I said about the astral body, it relates to the second initiation, but there are groups of devas that create the bridge between the devas of the astral plane and the devas of the Buddhic plane. If you see the rays and planes as spirals, a lot of this will be made very clear. The Buddhic plane interfaces with the astral like a corkscrew, and one enters the other. They're not cut off like dinner plates that are often because of the lack of certainly not comprehension, because the masters know all of this in its entirety, but they didn't have the tools to express it. And if my contribution, however small, is in this process, is trying to make what the masters have talked about and indicated, you know, we can't at this point, there's no way to express this. Well, you can express it, however inadequately, by the right symbols that they have given us. Okay, let's see. Prepares the man for the ninth or the final initiation, which enables the initiate in a manner incomprehensible to us to intuit in a blazing light the true nature of the cosmic astral plane. So this goes back to the opening statement. It appears very pretentious to link the lowly human astral plane with the cosmic astral plane, because their appearance is that they're so separated. But according to the law of correspondence, there is a tinge, however in miniature or tentative, in the astral body of each one of us, that through the Buddhic plane, through the monadic plane, and up onto the cosmic astral plane will take place if we're on that path. And it can be different with others who are more mentally polarized and are dealing more with the will. Forget not, the Buddhic plane is closely allied with the cosmic astral plane, and that all intuitions, when regulated, require the use of the creative imagination in their working out or in their presentation to the thoughts of men. And we're going to get into that in a little more detail. Okay, this is a fabulous quote that demonstrates visually what the Tibetan is saying and what I no doubt inadequately are adding on to that with my limited experience. Anyone like to read this quote by the Tibetan? Helial soul. Go ahead.
Yeah, Heliosol has her hand up. She also has a comment. Before you read, she has a comment that she's very grateful for this dynamic meditation and your explanation. To me personally, your work is divinely timed. Please do not stop. Your lessons are timely every time. Okay, go ahead, please, Heliosol.
Thank you. A triangle of force in shades of a varying rose. The master throws himself under the liberating law of sacrifice into the vortex of the astral life of the one to whom our Lord relates himself with humble joy. And as the master works, there forms before his eyes a triangle of force in shades of varying rose. By his magnetic power, he concentrates the energy required. Then, through this triangle of force, as through an open door, he sends the potency of love into our planet. Until his cycle ends, he thus must work.
I can remember in the 60s, late 60s, working with different other esotericists, and many of them shied away from working with color and sound because the Tibetan has given warnings that it's very powerful stuff because you're working with the devas. And if you identified the master or the cosmic astral plane with color, they often saw that as like some kind of glamour. And fortunately, there's been a huge maturing of the occult groups in the last 50 years that I've been participating with, because now they understand that until you're like a ninth degree Chohan, and not even working in the system, you are going to work with light of some type, and it's going to have a certain hue. And this is so beautiful because it clearly demonstrates that the cosmic astral plane, which is a certain very luminous rose color, can be worked on by the solar logos, the planetary logos, the masters in their different ashrams, the different disciples, and eventually shared through meditation and different types of group work down here on the physical plane. So there is one of your paths of return, and obviously seven colors, seven different paths of return. Your personality ray, and most of all your soul ray, will determine whether the triangles you create will be based on rose light of its different purities, golden light, fourth ray, seventh ray violet, first ray red, fifth ray orange, and I'm just third ray green. I'm just generalizing here for convenience. But you're looking at a sphere from the top down, and every spiral is a different dimension. Every ebb and flow, every descent of that is a different level. And people ask me, how does astral energy get to the buddhic plane? How does the buddhic plane energy get to the monadic, and then the monadic to the cosmic astral? It gets there because there is an unbroken tunnel, funnel, vortex, or triangle between all three of those points that are working simultaneously for the liberation of our solar logos, planetary logos, all the ashrams of the masters, working along that sixth ray line, and that there is a break in humanity's continuity of this process. He has a break in what DK calls the fourth subplane, and until he can build a bridge from the third subplane, which is lower elemental substance, to the fourth, and then from the fourth to the three higher subplanes of the astral and the mental plane, he is a prisoner of the planet. And if somebody were to ask, what's the procedure here? What's the overview in what we're trying to do? Is to show the organicness of energy and substance and force, how they operate on the inner planes. And okay, excellent. Thank you, Joe. Let's move to the next quote. And here it is reinforced again. A group of devas closely connected with the mysteries of initiation. They form what is esoterically called the path of the heart and are the bridge between the astral and the Buddhic planes. So again, you have devas that are working on our behalf on the purification of humanity and the planet, and they have sacrificed temporarily their bodies to become bridges between the astral and the Buddhic planes. So this just confirms what I just shared, that we've got to look at all the rays and planes as energies in motion and spiraling, corkscrewing through time and space. They are in no way connected with the permanent atoms in the causal body, but are very definitely associated with the central tier of petals in the egoic lotus, or with the petals of love. Force interacts between these three petals on the one hand and the devas who form the path of the heart upon the other. Those who are the bridge of astral Buddhic matter, whereby initiates of a certain mystic type make the great approach. And this next statement by me is not a statement of fact, it's just my opinion. Most of those who participate in this type of presentation, because it's not just my work, they are along that path of the astral Buddhic connection. Whereas those who are a little more occultly inclined are more the mental atmic. But that's not to say both of these approaches can't be bridged simultaneously, but they usually alternate from lifetime to lifetime, or perhaps even cycle to cycle. The great approach, the bridge, the devas are there for our benefit. Okay, use of the imagination to align with the divine will, which is life, the life aspect. The hierarchy is now a fact in your life and your awareness. What is the next fact or point of integration or consciously achieved inclusiveness? A study of the formulas and their correct use will reveal this to you. I have laid the emphasis upon visualization and given you some hints connected both with initiation and the creative work of the imagination, because these teachings and the development of these faculties will require calling into play your understanding if the formulas connected with initiation are to be given. Okay, I'm making the assumption, and I apologize if this is just my issue here, but I think a lot of people that come to this type of work, just like Francis Donald and others, they have taken the first two initiations, and again, I don't say this rigidly, and they're either coming up for the third initiation or they're participating in it. And to a large degree, what I am sharing here is supporting that. It's giving legitimacy. It's by not so much what I understand or my process, but by what the Tibetan is saying when you get to that level. This is not opening rudimentary stuff. It is, some of it is highly esoteric, and the images are even more esoteric because they're given by the masters. And let's just demonstrate this next one. Here is our solar system seen from cosmic levels. And it's obviously not my vision because I'm not anywhere near whoever constructed on the mental plane and then eventually filtered down. And then somebody like myself as an artist comes along and tries to put it in graphic form. But our solar system is a 12 petal lotus of the color blue. And then inside that you have the seven sacred planets, and they're in motion. That's why it appears to be a little blurry in the center. Okay, the solar logos blazes forth, second ray of the fourth order, and then the seven sacred planets emerge and the other non-sacred planets. And there's no way to depict this other than visualizing it. And these are the aids. These are the aids that I'm sharing for the second ray type that may have some difficulty in connecting in with that thought form. Now, I'm not saying if you visualize on this image, you're going to be instantly transported to the cosmic levels, but it is not something I created. It's something that I reflected that the masters have shared, 12 petal lotus on cosmic levels. And then you have the rainbow bridges, plural. And if you can imagine, those are the seven sacred planets, 1 through 7, and all the little dots are the groups and subgroups that those masters or those rays represent. Okay. Here's a very, very oversimplified outline of sort of what I just said, only adding a little bit with the actual planets and the masters that work through those particular rays. And we know every one of these masters works through all of the seven rays, but predominantly with one major one, two subsidiary ones, and then the other peripheral. And that may not be the correct word the Tibetan uses, but they're almost like they're just part of their makeup. They're like conscious of those, almost on a subconscious level. No doubt an incorrect description, but the only one I can pull together. So here you have, and if you look at the top where it says seven, Rocket C, who's taking the position of the Maha Chohen in this cycle because of the seventh ray's potency and need to integrate a lot that's already been shared by the hierarchy and defining where we're going in the next step. You'll see it says seven, where it says seven Uranus above it, it says seven subgroups. So if you're in a second ray group, love wisdom, but other people in that group, yeah, you have a lot in common, but there's things that aren't in common. That's because they may not be 7-1, which is seventh ray under the giving forth the first ray potency. 7-2, the second ray, love wisdom. Ray 3, active intelligence. So even the ashrams are very, very malleable and creative and have not just one, but seven and even 49 subsidiary ashrams that we don't really study because we may not be at the point where it matters to us whether we may know we're in to the seventh ray ashram or the ashram of the Christ, but the subgroups eventually you find your way onto. Okay. And now I'm going to do a animation that shows, it's the same image as this without the text, and it shows how that central impulse coming from the solar logos that created the thought form of all these sacred planets and unsacred planets that are not listed, and how all the masters were designated as regions to oversee these different rays and the different planets that they work through. So get into the flow of it and see yourself in the center as the soul, as the planetary logos, the solar logos, and radiating out with all your concentric bodies that are all connected by light, sound, and motion. Yes.
Dwayne, we have a couple of comments before we get to your video. Is that okay?
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Joe says that we're speaking of colors as we discuss the Boudiccan astral. Can
Yes.
we associate number to the atmic plane in rays 3 and 1?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure I fully understand it, other than that the atmic plane is often associated with active intelligence on a very, very high level, but also the will of the Father. And please ask that question again.
Yeah, I'll try. I was working with, I don't know, I was meditating this morning,
Yes.
and I may have picked up something that you're working on right now. But it suddenly occurred to me that Sanat Kumara is really at least threefold. He's personality, he's the heart, and he's the soul, but he's got other folks around him in
Yes.
Shambhala. And I said, oh my goodness, if we're working with 1 to 7, are they working with 10 to 70? Or how about 700 or 7,000?
I get it. Yes, you could be entirely right. I will say this, the masters indicate that as we go up through the ranks, all the energies begin to fuse and become simplified. And even though looking at it in one direction, I think your proposition, Joe, is potentially correct. It may diversify and become more separate as it hits manifestation on the different levels. But on the other hand, a lot of these subsidiary rays and planes, they fuse together as you go up through the rays, and that's why the third ray, you might say, is absorbed up into the second ray, and then the second ray into the first ray, as pralaya takes place. Everything is absorbed back into the Godhead. But then, when it's time for men, which is called pralaya, and then when manvantara or the outbreath comes, the one, the pure abstract, pure being, pure Fohat, it sends down these streams, these threads that create the second ray, third ray, and all the way down till the seven rays are created and the seven planes. So I don't know if that's answered your question at all, but that's sort of how DK describes it.
Thank you. It's more to think about.
Certainly is. Okay.
And then Greg says, when there is soul contact, as you were describing here, the higher planes are likely to unfold into a continuity of consciousness that binds us all on the middle and higher paths. I see your explanation as a subjective or abstract way for describing this long-term process of the building of our Antikoranas to the larger group Antikorana, of which may all be working out in the moment.
That is beautifully outlined, and I agree absolutely with every word of it. And it's hard for me to comment on that because you've just outlined the big picture and where things are going and sort of why we're here. Yeah, it's all about soul contact and it's about continuity. Okay, excellent. So now we're going to do another animation. And it's going to take the same visual that you see here, but just remove the type and imagine that you're at the center of this, whether it's the solar logos, the planetary logo eye, the monad, the soul on its own plane, or any of the other vehicles. Imagine that they are expressed in this rhythmic undulation, like a dewdrop falling into the shining sea, to quote the Tibetan. Now we're going to take some of the statements by the Tibetan about these formulas for group integration, which is actually one of the main purposes of these presentations, that the personality formulas and some of the preparatory formulas for soul work have been explored and given. But this is sort of a way of taking it even deeper and trying to mature some of those concepts and ideas. So let me read this Formula One called Integration of the Group Astral Nature. The first reaction is called the Formula of Revelation and is related to the united sensitivity of the group. As together, the group members brood upon and come to an understanding of the formula, they will swing into a responsiveness to the feeling and sensitive reactions of the individuals in the group, and these together constitute and form the astral body of the group. When this reaction has been established in a spirit of non-criticism and of love, will greatly aid in the process. The group together can arrive at the second purpose of the formula, which is called the discovery of the point within the circle. This signifies, as far as the group is involved, the revelation of the central coherent force of the group itself. This is, at the same time and until after the higher initiations, which we call the fourth initiation, the master at the center of the group. This is, consequently, the correspondence to the jewel in the lotus, where the individual is concerned, to the hierarchy, where humanity is concerned, and to the central point of all life in all forms, of form and of consciousness. The circle and the point are the natural symbols. Francis Donald did some wonderful presentations on the point within the circle, I think using the Tibetan and H.P. Blavatsky. And I recommend you review it if you get a chance. But what I want to do here, excuse me, is the group to understand that we have consciously and in some cases subconsciously been working on certain of the advanced group formulas that Tibetan has shared in his Dina books. And I may have mentioned this casually, but I mention it now because this group demonstrates a quality of humility and receptivity that I have not seen in many other groups I've worked with. And please don't take this as a criticism, because things are where they are. So let's take this point within the circle, and when you see the next animation that I'm going to present, think of how, over the last 5 years, I have repetitiously spoken about the importance of the vortex. And what you're really looking at here, the point within the circle that I'm going to bring up right now, is an example of that. I should have brought it up a little earlier. Sorry about that. The point of stimulation, or what is called the Laya point, and then it radiates out, creating concentric rings or levels of manifestation we call the rays and the planes. So everything really is inherent within this symbol, the point within the circle. And when we take it into full-blown animation, here you have the point within the circle and the three primary rays, rays one, red, rays two, blue, and the third ray is more violet purple. So you might say the seventh ray, which is really, it's taken precedence over the third ray temporarily through Master R's ashram and the seventh ray. But this is the perfect example of something that's lineal. And some people here may have powerful visualization capacities, and they can see this automatically. I have never had that power. But if I see an image that even vaguely represents what the Tibetan is stating, it really, really is impressive and potent to me. Okay, I think we might skip ahead to a little video I have that is about 10 or 12 minutes long. And it's actually a video on the psychic Edgar Cayce. And when I was younger, my mom had me exploring all kinds of psychic material. And she used to say Edgar Cayce was the best, and he was like 90 to 95% correct in his prophetic statements. And I've seen many videos on the life of Edgar Cayce, and they were good, but this one sort of went into his deeper work. And I would like to state that Edgar Cayce was one of the best Piscean psychics to ever have come down the human path. And no, he was not infallible. And this next video that I'm going to share with you, it's a little englamored in certain places. You've got to be able to overlook that and see the core and essence of what he's saying, because Edgar Cayce was very deep, and he just didn't have the technical knowledge, but he was a really second sixth-ray type disciple that devoted his entire life to helping other people. So, and we'll take a minute to discuss it afterwards, but let's see if I can zip down and find it. Okay, it's called 2026 Map Revealed, Edgar Cayce.
We stand today at the precipice of a new year. It is December 2025. Look around you. Look at the headlines that have dominated this past year. Look at the weather maps that seem to be bleeding red. And more importantly, look inside yourself. Do you feel it? That subtle, humming vibration of anxiety in your chest? That quiet, persistent intuition telling you that the rules of the old world, the economic rules, the geological rules, the societal rules we took for granted, are beginning to fracture? You are not imagining it. You are not paranoid. And you are certainly not alone. Nearly 100 years ago, long before the internet, long before climate change was a talking point, and long before the geopolitical tensions of 2025 took hold, a man in Virginia Beach sat in a chair, closed his eyes, and went to sleep. When he woke up, he had described this exact moment in our history. His name was Edgar Cayce. To the world, he was known as the sleeping prophet. To the desperate, he was a medical miracle worker. But to the history of human consciousness, he was something else entirely. He was a time traveler. He was a man who found a back door into the universal supercomputer, what the ancients called the Akashic Records, and he brought back a file marked for the future. For decades, scholars and skeptics alike have argued about his timelines. They thought he was talking about 1998. They thought he was talking about 2012. But the geological data, the magnetic shifts of the poles, and the specific fracture lines of our current society suggest that we have finally arrived at the destination he saw. The year 2026 is not just another number on the calendar. According to the Cayce readings, it represents a tipping point, a moment where the Earth itself stops whispering and starts speaking. Today, we are not talking about home remedies. We are not talking about dream interpretation. We are opening the forbidden dossier of Edgar Cayce's Earth Change prophecies. We are going to look at the map of the United States and Europe that he redrew while in a trance state. We are going to examine the specific warnings for the West Coast, the East Coast, and the capitals of Europe. And, perhaps most importantly, we are going to answer the question that keeps millions of people awake at night. Where is safe? The answer is not what you think. It is not a bunker. It is not a mountain retreat. It is something far more profound. But to understand the safety, we must first understand the storm. Why should we listen? Why should we trust the visions of a man who died in 1945 over the supercomputers and AI models of 2025? Because Edgar Cayce had a track record that defies statistical probability. Let's go back to 1929. The Roaring Twenties were in full swing. The American economy was invincible. The experts, the bankers, the politicians, they all predicted an era of endless prosperity. But 6 months before the crash, Cayce, in his sleep, saw blood on the streets of Wall Street. He warned of a catastrophic break. He was ignored. And then, the Great Depression brought the world to its knees. In 1935, while the world was desperately hoping for peace, Cayce described in chilling detail the formation of the Axis powers, the rise of Hitler, and the inevitable outbreak of World War II. He even predicted the dates of the beginning and the end of the war. He foresaw the death of two sitting US presidents. He described the location of the Dead Sea Scrolls decades before a shepherd boy threw a rock into a cave and found them. He described the splitting of the atom and the use of lasers when such things were science fiction. Casey did not guess. He accessed data. He believed that time is an illusion, and that every event, past, present, and future, is recorded in a field of energy. When he slept, he simply read the file. And the file he read for our timeline was a file of transformation. He called it the Earth Changes, and he warned that these changes would be physical, literal, and unavoidable. But he also gave us a key to understand why this is happening, so we don't fall into the trap of fear. Before we look at the map, we must put on the lens of Edgar Casey. We must understand the three cosmic principles that drive these events. Without these principles, what comes next sounds like a horror movie. With them, it looks like a birth. Principle number one, the Earth is a living being. Casey was explicit about this. The planet is not a rock. It is a conscious entity. It breathes, it feels, and it reacts. He explained that human thoughts and actions create a tangible energy. War, greed, hatred, and the exploitation of nature, these are not just social issues. They are energetic toxins. When these toxins accumulate in the body of the Earth, the planet must purge them to survive. It must shiver to shake off the fever. What we call earthquakes, what we call volcanic eruptions, Casey called a cleansing. The intense weather patterns we have witnessed throughout 2025 are not nature attacking us. They are nature healing itself. Principle number two, national karma. We often speak of individual karma, but Casey was the first to introduce the terrifying concept of national karma. He stated that a nation, just like a person, accumulates debt. If a nation is built on the destruction of others, or if a region becomes the center of material greed and spiritual blindness, that region attracts a specific kind of geological balancing. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. This law applies to continents as much as it applies to farmers. This helps explain why the map we are about to reveal focuses so heavily on the centers of modern power. Principle number three, the return of Atlantis. This is the piece of the puzzle that most people miss. Casey revealed that the vast majority of souls incarnated on Earth right now, especially in America and Europe, are the reincarnated souls of Atlantis. We have been here before. We are the same people who built a technologically advanced civilization tens of thousands of years ago. We are the same people who discovered the Firestone, a massive crystal energy source. And we are the same people who misused that technology, ignored natural laws, and caused the destruction of our own continent. We are back now, in 2025 and 2026, to face the same test. The stage is set. The technology is here. We call it AI and nuclear power. The greed is here. The question is, will we repeat the destruction, or will we finally learn the lesson? The shaking of the Earth is the bell signaling that the final exam has begun. Now, take a deep breath. We are going to open the file. We are going to look at the specific geographical warnings Casey gave for the Western world. This is the map of probability. Let's begin with the west coast of the United States. For years, geologists have talked about the big one, but Casey's vision was more specific and more disturbing. He didn't just see an earthquake, he saw a breakup. In reading 3,976-15, he stated clearly, Los Angeles, San Francisco, most all of these will be among those that will be destroyed even before New York. He spoke of the land in California being broken up. Why? Because the West Coast sits on the remnants of Lemuria, the Pacific continent of the past. It is a place of immense ancient energy. But modern civilization there has built a culture of extreme materialism and surface-level obsession. The disconnect between the land's spiritual history and its modern reality has created a fault line that is deeper than the San Andreas. Casey warned that we should watch the volcanoes. He said, if there are greater activities in Vesuvius or Pelee, then the southern coast of California and the areas between Salt Lake and the southern portions of Nevada may expect, within 3 months following same, an inundation by the earthquakes. In 2025, we have seen the Ring of Fire wake up. The indicators are flashing red. The land wants to return to the sea to be cleansed. Now, we move to the East Coast. If the West is a slow, grinding breakup, the East Coast prophecy is one of sudden, sweeping change. Casey warned, watch New York, Connecticut, and the like. He spoke of the disappearance of land. He said that in the final days of the cycle, the greater portion of Japan must go into the sea. The upper portion of Europe will be changed as in the twinkling of an eye. The twinkling of an eye. That phrase should pause us all. It implies speed. It implies that the gradual climate change models we are used to might be wrong. He spoke of a pole shift, a slipping of the Earth's crust over its core. This would cause water to slosh, displacing coastlines instantly. New York, a center of global finance, a symbol of the old world's power structure, sits directly on a karmic crosshair. Casey suggested that the Atlantic coastline would recede significantly. This is not about punishment. It is about the water reclaiming the land to purify the energy of the new Atlantis. And what of Europe? The vision is equally stark. Casey saw the map of Northern Europe changing drastically. He spoke of the land sinking in the north and rising in the south. Land will appear off the east coast of America, he said. There will be upheavals in the Arctic and in the Antarctic that will make for the eruption of volcanoes in the torrid areas, and there will be shifting then of the poles. As the ice melts, which we are watching happen in real time this December, the weight distribution of the planet changes. The crust becomes unstable. The geography of the United Kingdom, of Scandinavia, of the lowlands of Northern Europe is set to be redrawn. But amidst these warnings of destruction, there is a twist, a massive, unexpected revelation that baffles political analysts but makes perfect sense to the spiritual mind. Where are the safe zones? Where did Casey point to when he looked for the future of humanity? He pointed to two places that might surprise you. First, he pointed to the interior of the United States and Canada. He identified states like Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and the southern parts of Canada as the granary of safety. Geologically, these sit on the North American Craton, the oldest, most stable rock on the continent. While the coasts fracture, the spine will hold. He saw these lands becoming the centers of food production and the safe harbors for the rebuilding of society. And the second place he pointed to was Russia. In reading 3976-29, Casey delivered a prophecy that remains one of his most controversial and profound. He said, in Russia there comes the hope of the world. Not as that sometimes termed of the communistic or Bolshevik, no, but freedom. Freedom, that each man will live for his fellow man. The principle has been born. It will take years for it to be crystallized, but out of Russia comes again the hope of the world. He wasn't talking about the politics of 2025. He was talking about the spiritual destiny of a landmass. He foresaw that the West would collapse under the weight of its own materialism and debt, while the East, having suffered through its own purifications, would emerge with a new philosophy, a philosophy based on brotherhood, not profit. He saw a friendship forming between a healed America and a new Russia as the key to global peace. So we have the map. The coasts are red. The center is green. The geopolitical poles are reversing. I know how this feels to hear. I know the instinct that is rising in your gut right now. It is the survival instinct. It is the voice that says, I need to sell my house. I need to move to the mountains. I need to buy gold. I need to hoard food. That is a natural human reaction, but it is the reaction of the old earth. And Edgar Cayce did not come to give us old earth solutions. In the final moments of his most urgent readings, when people asked him, how do we survive? What should we do? Cayce did not give them a shopping list. He gave them a law. He said, spirit is the life, mind is the builder, and the physical is the result. This is the most important thing you will hear in this entire video. The map we just looked at is a probability. It is the physical result of our collective mind. But you have authority over your personal experience. The ultimate safe zone is not a place on a map. The ultimate safe zone is your frequency. If you are vibrating at the frequency of fear, of panic, of every man for himself, you act as a magnet for chaos. You could be sitting in the deepest bunker in the safest state in America, and the ceiling could collapse on you. Fear finds danger. That is the law of attraction. But if you shift your frequency, if you align yourself with the law of one, if you choose compassion, service, and inner peace, something miraculous happens. You become invisible to the storm. Cayce spoke of this protection often. He said that those who are in the light will be guided. You might get a sudden urge to visit a relative in another state 3 days before the earthquake. You might miss a flight that you were desperate to catch. You might be inspired to move to a new city for a job, only to realize later that you were being moved to safety. This is not luck. This is alignment. We are entering the age of Aquarius. The energy of this new age is about intuition and vibration. The old way of surviving was to build walls. The new way of surviving is to build consciousness. If you are watching this video in December 2025, while the world feels like it is spinning off its axis, it is not an accident. You are not a victim of this timeline. You are a volunteer. You are one of the souls Cayce spoke about, the ancient Atlanteans who vowed to come back and get it right this time. You are here to hold the light while the old structures fall down. You are here to be the calm in the center of the storm. So do not look at the map with terror. Look at it with understanding. The earth is changing her skin. She is preparing a new garden, and she needs gardeners. That is your job. We are going to make a choice right now, a choice that is more powerful than any bunker. We are going to choose our timeline. Do you choose the timeline of fear and destruction? Or do you choose the timeline of the new earth? If you are ready to be a part of the solution, if you are ready to stand as a pillar of light in 2026, I want you to make a declaration. Go to the comments below and write these words. I am ready for the new earth. Let this simple sentence be your contract with the universe. Let it be the signal that tells your guidance system, I am awake. Lead me to where I need to be. And listen closely, because this journey is just beginning. The map we discussed today is just the surface. deep beneath the sands of Egypt, under the paws of the Sphinx, lies a secret chamber that Edgar Cayce said would be discovered in our lifetime. He called it the Hall of Records. He said it contains the history of Atlantis, the history of the human soul, and the blueprint for the next phase of our evolution. And the signs indicate the door is about to open. In our next video, we are going to travel to Giza. We are going to look at the forbidden archaeology, the ground-penetrating radar anomalies, and the race against time to reveal the secrets of the Sphinx before the Earth changes seal them away forever. You do not want to miss that. Make sure you are subscribed. Make sure you have turned on notifications. The year 2026 is coming. The map is changing. But remember, spirit is the life. Stay in the light. Be the calm. And I will see you on the other side.
Okay. I would like to get any feedback from anyone who wants to share and just simply point out that since I didn't create the video, I there's some glamorous parts that I don't agree with. But overall, I think Edgar Cayce was attempting a very spiritual series of studies, research, and a lot of people have benefited from his work. And I think he, as I said earlier, before we jumped into this, he demonstrated one of the psychics from what I believe is the age of Pisces that we're leaving as we move into Aquarius. So you have to take some of these statements with a grain of salt, but I thought it was very interesting. So if anybody wants to share, Rose, I see your hands up. Please, please share. You're on mute, Rose.
She's unmuted, but I don't hear her.
Okay, while we're waiting for her to unmute herself, is there anyone else that would like to make a comment?
Well, we have some chats.
Okay.
Let me see. You're such a lifeline, Dwayne. This is from Jerry. He says, not sure about the video time. We'll tell. Selena says, wonderful, very interesting. Much gratitude and love. And Maureen says, link to this video, please. I will put the videos with the recordings like I always do, so you'll be able to look at it along with the recording. So.
Excellent.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. I can.
What I found interesting with the video is there were several, I would like to read the prophecies myself from his readings to see if the video is doing a proper interpretation. But there are several correspondences to what we've already know about in the Tibetan's works and in Theosophy, where Blavatsky goes into the history of Atlantis, the destruction of Atlantis, and Alice Bailey talking about the changes that would happen in California and different Earth changes. But I was under the impression from those teachings that these are very gradual changes, and maybe with a pole shift we might have more sudden changes in other locations. That's well, I think it's interesting the correspondence to what was from the Tibetans' works and from Blavatsky, but that there is this whole chain of karma that you don't ever, as humanity goes through its cycles, that do not, there's no shortcut, there's no skipping ahead. The karma has to be reconciled in one way or another, and it's not to say it always needs to be through something negative, and it's, karma is not a tit for tat, but it's a evolutionary process, an evolutionary law, and these cycles come back and repeat. And I do see, with our modern society, an earlier cycle of a heightened civilization coming back and repeating that cycle, but where the lessons have to be, hopefully, at the turn of the spiral, a more, what's the word, fruit gained from that long form of experience. But whether these things are, like you said, maybe some glamour in that is, it's kind of where, as humanity is experiencing this, and we are a part of that humanity, I think it's more gradual, and that there's a definitely a testing that humanity's going through, ever, even way before now. It started in the First World War, was a part of that Atlantean testing period, as Bailey very frequently reiterated. In the Second World War was a part of that test, and she said, the Atlantean test, and she said that the test is not over, that the war is not over, these forces of evil have not been defeated in the consciousness of man, and that there will be future tests where then there'll be that final sealing of the door where evil dwells, that we're still in this work in progress towards that. So, but every test is an opportunity for consciousness to grow, and for that invocation of the spirit and of the realignment of the principles that are eternal, and every test provides for that. So, as in the video it said, it's all for the good, even if there is difficulty or crises. It's through crises that consciousness and evolutions proceed. So that's pretty much all. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for those deep insights. Anyone else like to share before we close? Okay, I would just say in passing that.
Sorry,
Oh, go
I
ahead.
was just checking messages and stuff.
Okay.
A lot of gratitude. Thank you. And then Vivian says today on BBC News, we heard it was confirmed that Alexei Navalny was indeed poisoned by a very rare toxin. He was a believer in Christ, and his life was a demonstration of sacrifice for freedom and the awakening of Russia to its true character.
Excellent. Isn't there a triangle BL between Russia, Great Britain, and the US that the Tibetan talks about?
It could be, I don't recall it right now, but he talks about a number of triangles relating countries based on their rays and purpose and
Excellent.
stuff. So, and
Thank
then
you.
Ben says remote viewing the future 2050 and 2060. Stephen Schwartz, psychic archaeologist, carrying on the Casey work with large team of viewers. So Stephen Schwartz
Excellent.
has information.
Well, I
And then
think the.
Heidi says, oh,
Go ahead,
sorry. Yeah.
Heidi.
Heidi says, thank you for all that has been given. Grateful for gathering the wisdom, the love, and the intelligence that is present. So, okay, that's all I see
Thank
right
you,
now.
Heidi. Excellent. So I would simply summarize that the emotional nature and astral body of humanity has an important contribution to make. And just because there's a lot of discomfort on a planetary level and within individuals does not mean that when the astral body is centered and calmed, it can't be a great revelatory organ of receptivity to the love and wisdom of God, as outlined in the earlier quotes. So thank you very much. Appreciate your contribution, and it'll give us something to think about. Love you all, and may your journey be light. Thank you, BL Rose.
Thank you, everybody, and I'll get these videos posted as soon as I can.
Excellent. Love and light.
And light, and happy Valentine's Day to everyone.
Yes.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.